Jason, we friends just having a conversation.
Wave your hands, hands high. Don't stop.
All right, thank you for coming back, or if this is your first time listening, thank you for coming. This is North Texas Music Fanatics. I am Jason Janik, and we discuss all the fun stuff about Texas music. The show's been kind of hyper-focused on Deep Ellum. We've discussed some Denton and some Arlington, Fort Worth. We just want to hear all about the wonderful stuff that Texas has to offer. And we're about to start another great episode. Before we do that, I do want to say Instagram and Patreon. NTXMF. That's how you find us there. Go ahead and join. And I guess from what all the other cool kids say, you're supposed to subscribe and like and all that kind of crap. Whatever works. I want to know that y'all are enjoying this. I don't make any money off of this. I do it for the love of music. I do it for the love of all my friends who have amazing bands, have amazing stories, and I know this stuff needs to get shared. But Patreon really helps. I got some equipment I want to buy. $3 level would be great. That's not even the cost of a Coke these days, so if you can sign up with that, I would really appreciate it. Speaking about our higher level Patreon members, if you want to say thanks to Beth, maybe you listened to her episode a while back. She actually does therapy now, so if you need any mental health help, if you need somebody to talk to, she understands the head of an artist. She understands somebody who might be in your position right now. Check it out. I've got a link to Vervewell on the Instagram page, or I'm sure you can probably just Google it. But enough about that. Let's get into this episode. This is going to be a fun one. I first saw this person, think, at Fry Street Fair, if I remember correctly. And then I saw the band a couple more times live in Deep Ellum. I remember hearing the albums, hearing the music. I think I've got all their stuff. I have to look back and see if I'm missing a 7-inch or something. We'll discuss the catalog here in a second. But
yeah, I've got some stuff I can add to it for sure.
Let me introduce George Reagan.
Hello, very nice to be here.
Yeah, this is fun. So we're out here in Denton. You got this awesome little music space where you can create, which is great. I want you to keep creating. I love the stuff you do.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, man. I mean, yeah, this is my manic creative space. I'm either sleeping, working, or...
So...
Yeah, that's it. This is it.
Let's discuss your beginnings. I think most of our listeners are going to know you from Hagfish. That was a pretty big thing here in Dallas. It was a decently big thing all around the country. I remember you were on Loveline, which was a big show back on MTV back then.
Oh, we also did Europe quite a bit. Yeah,
you've done quite a bit of stuff that most bands would kill for.
Yeah.
So was Hagfish your first band?
No.
Okay.
It was not my first.
Let's discuss those beginnings then.
So the first band with some friends from high school, middle school at the time, moving into high school. Yeah, I mean...
Is this all here in Texas? Have you always been
Texas.
Here?
It's in Texas. It was in Louisville.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a Judas Priest cover band, basically. I mean, cover bands weren't a thing. I mean, not like a specific band, but yeah, metal. I played bass because everybody else played another instrument. And that's what they didn't have. That band and Friendship went on to do, you know, change and grew over the years. And we played Circle A Ranch, Twilight Room. When we got older, you know.
Yeah.
And then we switched over to, well, it's funny. That band was called Uncle Scam, and I actually don't have any recordings of it because they're pretty horrible. I mean, that you got to realize that in the 80s, I hadn't come out as queer or as gender fluid at that time. And I was kind of in Stockholm syndrome with all these people who were pretty, you know, anti-queer. I mean,
Louisville, Fighting Farmers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Fighting Farmers.
You know, kind of Friday Night Lights type.
I got my ass beat a lot.
Yeah.
But there was that stigma and people called me, you know, all kinds of things. And I felt it when they did. So, but that music that I wrote back then, it wasn't very friendly to, it isn't who I am now, you know. You know, it was punk, and then it was crossover, but I really don't feel comfortable with those lyrics.
Yeah, but the good takeaway from that is it's proof that as a human, there's always growth.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to make this into a show about philosophy or psychology, but I always look back at the stuff that I was doing in high school and in college, and the stuff that as a Gen X person we thought was cool and okay. And as you grow, you realize there's much more. There's more you should be thinking about.
Absolutely, so yeah.
I get it.
And you know, my whole life has been figuring myself out.
Yeah.
And so, you know, at 16, I was a terrible kid. I fought a lot. I didn't know that I was also on the autism spectrum. So I didn't realize why I was always trying to escape from people and escape from parties or, you know, over drinking or fighting, you know, but it was small steps and epiphanies and growth. Yeah. Not to make it about that, but it seems like I learned a lot about myself. You know, every decade was like a new me, and that was good. That band, by the way, turned into Scam. We decided we were going to do something that nobody else had done, which is a very funny story. We decided we were going to mix punk and metal, and we started doing that. And then the band DRI came out with an album called Crossover.
Oh, yeah.
And I was so mad. Because I love DRI, but I realized that we weren't the only people thinking that at that time. That band went on to go to CMJ Music Marathon in New York, and we played the same stage with Yola Tango and all these other bands, you know, that I was just fanatical about. And you rode an elevator with people from the Misfits and you know, bands like MOD, SOD, Anthrax, all these bands at the time. Tried out for Corrosion and Conformity when they were looking for a new singer. It was a total shit show, actually, but decided at that moment when we were talking to record labels that I no longer wanted to do it. I got scared.
Sure.
I didn't want fame all of a sudden, and I just bailed. I just bailed and came home.
Is that still kind of a consistent
thing
with you? Yeah,
the same thing happened in Hagfish. Yeah. I bailed and wanted to, just didn't want to do it.
Because I remember every time that I saw you on stage, there was this presence. And it seems so strong and so commanding. And it was almost like if you took the confidence of a Freddie Mercury and put it into like the character of 1980s Superman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I saw on stage.
Wow.
So to know that as an individual, you're feeling the complete opposite.
I was crumbling inside. You know, there was a...
Yeah,
I don't want to say it's a facade because what you're getting is you were getting me, but I'm just a very, you're getting the dressed up and the suit, George.
Yeah.
You know, you're getting all the you know, I don't know. I don't even know. It's the music does it for me. The music can propel me into a certain mind space. But I would drink before the show and try to show up right after the band started playing, and then I would leave before the band finished playing and go hide. I mean,
what I hear from a lot of artists, whether it's a comedian or a musician or whoever, and I've even seen it with photographers and myself included, when you get in the zone and you're doing it, it can kind of take on its own persona.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You're cool.
Absolutely.
With it. But then, like you said, right before, or right after, then you have to realize, well, I'm myself again.
Yeah.
So I understand that duality.
And there's a certain thing about that, though. So a lot of the things that I would say on stage were things I would say at home. And so there was this moment of comfort where I felt like I could be myself. And it was usually when I would say something that would be like, you know, awful or funny to Zach or whatever. We would be riffing and I would get comfortable. But, you know, that wasn't an act. That was me becoming comfortable on stage, and it happened every night. It was like Groundhog Day.
The riffing and the joking that you mentioned, I know, you know, I'm not diagnosed, but I've got close friends and people who I was with, and they said, you know, you're clearly on the spectrum. And I got a child who has been diagnosed.
Yeah.
And I noticed that the way that I break down and I use humor.
Oh, coping mechanism.
Yeah.
So you can guarantee the first thought I ever have in a situation is the worst thought. Yeah. And back then I didn't have a filter. It would just come out. And that was my coping mechanism, just to say the worst thing that was
and,
in my
and you
head.
Could make everyone around you laugh like you were like a Jerry Seinfeld, except for the one person that the joke was at the expense of.
Yeah. And then you feel bad about it later. But yeah. I mean, yeah, it's one of those things. And yeah, it's a coping
mechanism. But you learn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still do it. Just recently we played a show, it's I call him Muzak. It's my friend Chris Bright. He's my new music partner, and we play shows and spend probably half the show talking and making jokes. He's like a much higher intellect and education level than me, so the jokes get really funny because I don't know what he's talking about, and so it's a whole different element. But there's still that release of, you know, letting loose and it's the anxiety release.
Yeah.
Of so saying dumb stuff or whatever it is.
Or finding a way with your analytical autistic mind to connect two things that are so absurd that it absolutely just makes people on the floor rolling around laughing.
Yeah, or saying, but what the fuck are they talking about?
Looking back on it, you probably shouldn't have said it.
Yeah, absolutely.
100% I get it.
I can tell you two really good instances when this happened, because my wife is more than likely on the spectrum. I mean, people gravitate towards each other.
Exactly.
But you say things, and I can't say this. There's very, very funny stuff. Maybe I can say this. Maybe you can just beep it out.
That makes a lot of sense.
And we're still laughing about those later. These are things that never, ever stop being funny. And I'll just give you one, and you can edit it out if you want to. When my wife and I were dating, and I don't drink, right? I stopped drinking a long time ago. That was a big help. But she had a little bit of wine, and she was trying to let me know that she was the one for me. She's Italian, so she's got a lot of that bravado. And she said she had word salad. She didn't say the right words, but we were camping in a RV park, a really nice one. Yeah. You're not supposed to be allowed past 9, and I think the toilet had exploded on us because of the we'd gone.
You had the gray tank or the black tank too full, possibly.
Yeah, but the altitude was different. Oh, so sure. We couldn't figure out how to flush it, so we pulled it and it exploded. So we had to go take a shower. We're coming back. It's like 10 after quiet time. And she's saying, you know, I got a first grade pussy. And I was like, honey, I think I know what you're trying to say, but I don't think that's right. She was like, and so she was like doubling down. And she said that over and over and louder until the whole place could hear it. And that is still a joke today.
Well, yeah, that's one of those fun things that you can always look back on. I know that with my wife, you know, we've got things that we can look back on, and we're like, that just was funny and absurd and different.
And I'm not supposed to tell people these things, but they're so hilarious to me, because she meant grade A or whatever.
Well, that's when you got to write a sitcom, and then you just work that in, and people don't know it's real, but you know it's real.
Oh, I'll tell you about the sitcom. We got one of those coming.
Yeah, awesome. So here's the cool thing about this show. My kind of tagline is, it's two friends talking. So whatever we talk about, it's fine. I am going to direct us back towards music,
though. Absolutely.
I know a lot of people want to hear about your musical exploits, because it's massive. I mean, if I think about the royalty of North Texas, if you say that somebody like Erykah Badu is the queen and Toadies are the kings, you'd be right there as a prince. I mean, you are up there. You're North Texas rock royalty.
Oh, man, I mean, that's a lot to digest, because I ran from it. But I totally appreciate that comment. I mean, I for some reason feel that when I disappeared and went off to hide, that everybody forgot about it. But it's funny, people keep coming back and saying, it was good and it was great. And I'm just like, was it good and great? And I have to go back and listen and say, well, it wasn't bad, you know. And I had a really great time up to a certain point. So thank you. I'm glad to be like lumped in with all this. But, you know, Toadies double platinum, you know. I mean, we would go open up them in Florida and there'd be an arena. So, I mean, there's huge, and then there's kind of cult classic where, you know, like we could do 1,000 people, 2,000 people in each major city at one point, but the Toadies could do thousands and thousands of people anytime. So there is a scale, hierarchy there.
If you're only going to rate it on how many people fit in the venue, or you know, how many albums you sold. I think a lot of North Texas music would get knocked down several notches.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Because even the Spree, as huge and fanatic as their fans are,
yeah.
I mean they're not going, you know, quadruple platinum. They're not a Taylor Swift.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. I think what I grade things on is, yeah, were they reasonably successful? Did they make it on something on TV? Did they get a chance to play a festival at a decent time slot? Are they filling places and everyone is going absolutely nuts? There's
that definitely
so
happened.
Much to consider.
That definitely happened.
Oh, I know it did. I had a friend. I was covering a Hagfish show at Gypsy. I think for Harder Beat magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a plus one. And I had a friend who, he was just going nuts. And he was like, you don't know how much this band means to me.
That's
and we
great.
Get there and it was like he went to Disney World.
That's awesome.
And that, yeah, I mean, that's gotta humbling. Be amazing.
It's
feeling.
Humbling because I'm also kind of shy about it. And I know I don't seem like the kind of, like the Hagfish George doesn't seem like the shyest person, but like, I'm probably turning red. People have come to me and said things like that. And like, you know, I can see my child, two Hagfish in the backseat of my car. And it's like, and I'm always so flattered. And
possibly to stamp.
Possibly to stamp, which is a funny story. But I mean, that to me is, I do have to step back and go, wow, there are people who still appreciate that.
Yeah.
And I got to like respect that. You know, because Donnie and Zach and Tony, like especially Zach, that you know, Hagfish is still his favorite band. I mean, it is what he says anyway. It's his baby. You know, like he won't even let anybody put the Rock Shirley Mass on vinyl because if it's going to be done, it has to be done right. You know, he's like holding on to that. Oh, this is my baby band, so it means a lot to him. And he's in Rise Against.
I mean, yeah, I was going to say both of the Blair brothers have gone on.
And, yeah, they're doing great things. I mean, they're sustaining a musical career beyond anyone's wildest fantasies, right? And so that's amazing for them, and I'm so proud of them. But for Zach to say, yeah, that's my baby favorite band, and I can't like just let people misrepresent or this or that, he wants to hold on tightly to it, makes me feel really good because I felt we had something special as a band.
Oh, yeah, you certainly did.
We were friends first, and the music just... Well, I don't know which was first, but it was so intertwined. I mean, we lived, breathed, and everything together every day. It was like we were one single unit.
Let's do this, because there's about a million different ways that I could go with this conversation. And I know we're way over time from where I normally put in a song. So let's take a break. Let's hear something from Hagfish, and we'll come back and we'll talk more. How's that sound?
Yeah, great.
All right, let's do this.
Your little smile fills me up, and I will never give you up. Yeah.
that was definitely good. That brought back some memories. So let's there's a million things that I want to talk about. I know this is a music centered podcast, so let's discuss a little bit more about that. We've got Tony on drums, who
it's a beast.
Yeah, I mean he puts like Motley Crue to shame. You can see his influences.
Yeah, we stole him from Cool Christine, from Johnny Hawkins.
He
was so good.
You can tell where he gets his showmanship.
Oh yeah,
but man, it was tough watching Hagfish, and especially photographing Hagfish, because there's so much going on from each member.
And I was the still one. Joey Ramone in it. I'm just like trying to like stay calm. Everybody else is going insane.
I think that's what I saw, was a little bit of that stoic confidence up front. And you're right. I think that helped elevate you. It's like you're the straight man with all this energy all around you.
Yeah.
So
yeah. I was a subdued one.
Like the ringleader.
Subdued one, yeah. Because I want to be sedated situation. I was usually tanked during most of those shows, and the rest of the guys are sober, so they're just going nuts.
Well, the audience was going nuts too, because I know at least one of the shows I had to spend half the time helping to keep all of the crowd surfers and everything from destroying my camera, there was a shorter female right in front of me, and she was doing really well at protecting herself. But some of these, you know, like the Doc Martens and stuff coming straight at us, those shows got wild. They were fun.
No, the chaos was so awesome. And I usually wore shades because I didn't want to be able to see, because I don't, you know, to see people, I get anxious. But every once in a while I'd get a glimpse, or I'd take them off, and I'd see the chaos, and I'd be like, oh my God, this is amazing. Well, of course, especially when people are singing your songs back to you, by the way, which is the one thing that I think about today still on why I want to do music still, is because nothing's better than hearing people sing back to you over and over and over.
There's a special connection.
Very special. I mean, you got to say to yourself, okay, if all else fails and all the trouble and ups and downs in life, that one thing is the most magic thing. And so if I can, you know, to have that, it's just worth everything. It's worth all the trouble and everything I've gone through. Just hearing people sing your words back.
Yeah, I can imagine. So tell me this, Hagfish Forms. You said that you guys were all pretty much friends from the beginning. I mean, how does the band get to where they are? Where are you first playing?
Well, friends at the beginning. So I was actually homeless at the time and living in the back of a rehearsal studio at a t-shirt shop. And I wasn't really doing music, but I had written a bunch of songs. And I heard a band practicing, because it was a whole bunch of rooms. And I heard this band, it sounded like Descendants All. They didn't have a singer. And they were so good. And that's when I just kicked the door in and was like, where's your singer? You know, they're like, we don't have one. I was like, I got a bunch of songs. Can I, you know, and they were like, yeah, let's just try a couple. And it was like immediate connection. Like, I couldn't have picked a better band that knew everything that I liked about music.
Yeah.
And was solid. And that started the friendship. And from then I moved in with the band, you know, different people in the band, and we just became really good friends. You know, they were a solid band. They just needed a singer. I think their singer had passed away not too long before that. But that was really like where it started. And from then on, we were just tight as could be. Yeah. I think we only got in a few fistfights, you know, after 7 years of touring, 275 days a year, we started to get, you know, a little touchy. But other than that, we were best friends.
Yeah, but that's with every band.
Yeah.
A band is a relationship.
Yeah.
So even if I have a fight with my wife, you know, it's part of a much bigger thing.
Right. Well, yeah, it is part of a much bigger thing.
Yeah.
But the thing about that is like, so when that happened in that room, that very first rehearsal where I stepped in and showed them a couple of my songs, and it came out exactly how I would want to hear it, I knew for me, it was something special for me. And I immediately, and I was self-employed, you know, and homeless, but self-employed at a t-shirt shop. And I was like, we're going to develop and we're going to get shows. Like, and I made it my life force for several years. That's all I did, was go to clubs and meet people. And I had to put the autism, you know, tendencies. I had to just do it. And I met every club owner, every door person of every single club until we got a show, which was a battle of the bands at Trees on like a Thursday night. And that one show, people ask, will you play another show? And then it just snowballed. And before you know it, you had like George Gamark playing us on the air and Dragon Street Records, all these people. It happened so fast, I didn't even know what was happening, but my life changed immediately. My focus in life changed immediately. I went from like just trying to survive to here's something worth living for.
Do you remember? You remember what year that was?
It's probably going to be 91.
Okay.
Yeah, 91.
So you're
91 because 92 was when Dragon Street, I believe, started recording the album.
Okay.
The first album. So yeah, it was a and year then, of and then solid.
And by 93, you guys are the kind of the talk of the town. It's interesting you say that because there are a few bands that all have the same story. Tripping Daisy kind of hit the scene with an open mic and blew up. I know that Steven with Tablet around the same exact time was just all of a sudden boom. And there must have just been something special about that era in
I can tell you what it was. It was I could tell you exactly what it was. And it was people like George Gamark running The Edge. I mean, I don't know if you remember The Edge. Do you remember the first time it came on the air? I mean, I heard the Pixies the first day I turned it on and was like, oh my God, I'm hearing the Pixies on the radio. And I would not stop listening to that station. And then I heard local bands on that show. And I was like, oh my God, they support local bands. And so that, to me, there was a perfect storm between the radio station, that radio station specifically, and KNON also was really good about that. And there were others, but that collaboration, like with Bill from Bill's Records.
Yep.
And so you had the record stores, and then you had the Deep Ellum, who was primed and ready. So you put that whole piece together, and you had other players like, you know, booking agents and all these bands, all this creativity come all at once. I mean, and it was prime and ready. A Dallas Observer was writing about everybody.
Yeah.
And so
I forget when the Met started, but you also said the Met was talking about a lot of local music.
The Met. Yeah. The Met was the Observer, the Met. I mean, there are all these great things, these great pathways. It's like you could go from nobody has heard you and playing in front of 25 people 2,000 people just from a couple of rotations on the Edge back then. And one right up in the Observer. And before you know it, it was crazy. It was crazy.
Well, even into the late 90s and early 2000s, I remember seeing, and they were still pretty young at this time, I remember seeing Chomsky open for Tripping Daisy. And the crowd loved them. But as soon as they had their first single that Josh played on Adventure Club, all of a sudden, the shows went from maybe half full to being you can't find a spot in the place.
And those were the people that were the catalyst.
Yeah.
Yeah. Josh definitely is one of those. Alex, all those guys, they knew what they liked, and they played it regardless of what people thought. I mean, they would play it in normal rotation. Kind of what got George Gamark gone from when Clear Channel came in, right? I mean, they totally ruined the whole scene. And took, you know, one of the godfathers of the music scene, pulled him out of his place. I mean, that was horrible.
Even if you don't look at something like The Edge and you go to something a little more pop oriented, I used to do some shoots every once in a while for 106.1.
Yeah.
And early on, there was a lot more flexibility. And as corporate took over more and more, it just became more and more stiff to where it wasn't even worth messing with.
And that's crazy because, you know, well now we don't have radio like we used to have it, although we do have some great radio stations, Deep Ellum Radio. KNON has always been great. KTU? It's the Denton station.
Yes.
They're awesome. I know that I have it on my preset on my radio, but anyway, those are all amazing, and there's more. But it's not the same as it was back then. It was a very rapid build, and not only that, the record labels. Well, you know, there was the South by Southwest thing too. Then a lot of the Dallas bands were not allowed to play; they wouldn't let them in. We had Ann Richards wrote a letter for us because we opened up for it at UNT. She came. We were playing a show, and she came down in a helicopter and dropped us. That's where Josh saw us. She dropped down and did her speech, And when South by Southwest wouldn't let us play that year, Ann Richards wrote him a letter shaming them for not letting Dallas bands play. And that really was the catalyst for, I mean, and the Toadies, I think, had already been signed. And then, you know, Tripping Daisy had already been signed.
Yeah.
But, like, that's when it just, like, people were here in Dallas every weekend looking for bands, people from all over, record labels. And that was bizarre. Because, I mean, then you're getting offers to go to the Super Bowl, 20-yard line or whatever. And I'm like, is this what you have to do to be on a record label? I just want to talk and look at contracts. I don't want to.
The funny thing is,
it's just like people buying houses now.
Yeah.
People trying to outbid each other. And it was insane. That's probably why it was so rough.
Well, and I look at what it did to the scene, because then you had people coming in just trying to snag somebody so that another label wouldn't snag them.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not the same as being gung-ho and for a band. It's more like, I just don't want my competition to have the band.
Yeah, and that really, that you could say that big money came in and kind of just stripped the scene. Yeah, it really did. And the scene is there again, right?
It's building back up. There's definitely something there. Yeah.
I started going to shows, and because, I mean, this is a very eccentric thing to say, but when I moved to Denton, let me see, 2012? I can't remember when I moved back to Denton. But Denton wasn't doing so good.
Everything around that time. It's funny you say that, because I have maybe, I don't know exactly how to explain it. If you take your trajectory and a lot of things you're saying, I'm like, you know, a lot of this is familiar with my parallel, where I started to become really big because I was shooting all the covers for Quick, and I was shooting for Spin Magazine, and I was shooting, you know, all the Bowling for Soup album covers. But I got freaked out because people knew my name and would come up to me that I didn't know.
Right.
And then I kind of hit away. Around 2011, I had a divorce. And I changed my complete thing. we all go through stuff.
Yeah, we do.
And so I completely changed my trajectory and kind of laid low. Like you said, you laid low.
Yeah.
And I've noticed that, you know, recently, as my kids have gotten old enough, I've decided I'm going to come back and do a lot of the same, just like you're doing.
That's exactly what's happening.
And I think the scene was going through the same kind of thing, because, like you said, around that time, Denton changed. Around that time, you saw a huge shift in Deep Ellum.
Yeah,
it was almost like it wasn't just me and it wasn't just you. Oh,
everything
changed.
Yeah, everything changed, and it was weird. So the very eccentric and uninformed statement that I made when I first moved to Denton, when somebody asked me, "Well, why did you move back to Denton?" And I said, "Well, because I want to make Denton suck less." You know, and that's really, really just a dumb thing to say, because Denton has never sucked. It just was in a lull.
I get exactly what you mean.
But that's what I felt. I felt like, well, I've got, you know, a decade of songs I haven't released. There's 1,000 incredible musicians here, and, you know, I can open up my studio and we can just let loose. And the thing about it is like, all these places were coming and going, and the scene was just so weird. And I would go to places and I'd be like, man, are there any good bands? And I just didn't look hard enough. And the thing is, there were little scenes that were fantastic that I didn't find out about till later. Like Marked Men, I didn't even know until after they were done that they were playing in Denton. And they're one of my favorite bands of all time. So I also didn't look hard enough because I was hiding.
Yeah, and I mean, there's also something about being at a different stage of your life, because I could have gone to the Baboon and Brainiac show that just happened.
Man. So much would have been there.
But I had a shoot, and the shoot didn't end until later. And by the time I got home and ate and would have had a change and get down there, I was like,
I can't do
it. It's tough.
This is my life story lately, because I got more shows that I want to go to now. I used to keep it down to 2 a year, right? That was my limit. 2 shows a year, which isn't shit. You can't learn anything about a scene.
Yeah.
And if you're going out twice a year. So now I'm trying to go like every other weekend. And it's like, okay, well, I'm going to go see John Buffalo, Dufilo. I want to see, like, there's too many things going on for me to go to everything. And I have to pick and choose. And it's really, really hard.
Well, even just with John, you could
see him.
You could see him 20 different times in 20 different projects.
With different beats. Yeah, I know, right? But the thing is like, specifically his new album.
Yeah.
The John Buffalo album. So during the pandemic, him and I were sending music back and forth. It's when I kind of like really started bonding with him.
Mm-hmm.
And
which, speaking of, I saw that he produced some of those songs that you've got, and you can tell signature on those.
Oh yeah, he's fantastic. Yes. And I plan on working with him for the rest of my musical life. Right.
You're like Rhett Miller and Salim, the way they connect and they make gorgeous stuff because of that connection.
Fantastic stuff. But the thing is at the time when I started talking to him, I had lost my voice. You know, we talked about Amy going back to vocal lessons.
Mm-hmm.
When I decided I wanted to sing, and it happened, you know, the thing is, I was like, okay, I'm going to get my music back together. I'm going to do something. Well, everybody's too busy in Hagfish, so I'm going to do my own thing. It's like I went to go like start writing and singing, recording, and I couldn't sing anymore. I was like, oh, I went through the Fat Elvis phase, and now I'm deteriorated. So this was like right before the pandemic. I was going to do my first show over at, it's called the Never Sleep now. It was Golden Boy Coffee. It's just two blocks over, right? I was like, I'm going to do my first show there. I'm going to make that my place and just start doing shows there. Hopefully build a crowd there. And then the pandemic happened. And then I just was like, I guess I'm not going to do that. And then I realized I couldn't sing.
Yeah.
So that's when John and I started working together. And I'd send him stuff and he'd be like, yeah, this is great. Got to work on those vocals. And I'd be like, yeah, my vocals are horrible. So I didn't get to see a vocal coach until it was a year ago. Fantastic vocal coach here in Denton. And I got my voice back.
That's good.
So now I'm almost ready.
I've never been a good singer, but I think it was maybe 2014, something around there. I wound up getting some sort of cough or virus that really affected my voice.
Yeah.
And ever since then, I can't even do karaoke properly. So.
Yeah, it's a weird one. So
it's easy to lose that.
I have to take medication to make sure that everything's open. Mm-hmm. I also have to warm up. You know, it didn't used to be that hard. Well, you know, okay, so we'll tell you, Hagfish, I lost my voice every night on stage for like a year when we first started doing tours, like around the country. And they had to send me to a vocal coach. It was one, maybe two lessons. This lady in Houston, she was like $500 an hour. I just wasn't singing right.
Yeah.
Never lost my voice again after that. But the power of like... knowing how to sing, which I didn't for many, many years, it's so abstract and not natural. But 6 months with a vocal coach, a good one, is priceless. Yeah. I mean, I feel like I should give any future royalties a portion to my vocal coach because it wouldn't happen without her. Yeah.
Well, it's like with any profession where anybody thinks they can do it until they learn the professional way to do it. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
We should put in another song now. We normally put in a song about somebody we talked about. I know we mentioned John Dufalo. We could maybe play something from his new album. We could play something from Death Ray Davies.
Is that how you say his last name?
I always say it Dufalo. Am I saying it wrong?
I think it's Dufalo. Oh. I could be wrong. It's the funny thing is, I don't think I've ever had him tell me in
that's
person.
That's the thing about it is... every time I talk to him, I just, you know, it's John.
John. It's John.
And like we were talking before we started recording, you know, I'd always known Amy. And then right before we start, I'm like, okay, so it's, I'm going to introduce you, Amy Curnow. And she's like, oh no, it's actually Amy Curnow.
I thought it was Curnow as well. Yeah.
I mean, with my name, you know, Janik, there's a whole faction that spell it the same way, but they go Yannick.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So yeah.
It's, John, is it Dufalo? Let us know.
Yeah, John. I'm gonna talk. I'm gonna see you Saturday.
Oh
this,
yeah,
the 17th.
I'm gonna
be there.
You show.
You're taking a picture.
I am. I'm gonna be there
with Steve Holt.
Yep, that's right.
I can't wait to see him.
Okay, so let me I'm gonna pick something at random because he's got like a million different projects and a million different great songs. So what if we play this? We'll be right back. Yeah, John Stuff, man. I we could play 100 songs of his.
Yes.
And I'd still be happy. I don't know how he does it. I mean,
he does it like I do it, but 10 times harder and way more efficiently.
Yeah. Let's discuss some more music. So Hagfish eventually breaks up. Let's get into some more current stuff.
You don't want to know how it broke up? You know, the
I think we can discuss whatever you want to discuss.
I mean, you probably, I don't know if you know, I mean, we were on London Records, right?
Okay.
They didn't hear a hit on the new record. Now, realize they'd paired us with Bo Hill, who had produced a recent Roger Daltrey album and maybe Rat Out of the Cellar. I wasn't sold on this guy whatsoever, but we hated everything we had done with them. Between that and them saying that they didn't hear a single, I was like, okay, I guess we're not going to fulfill the contract. And I got really disgruntled. There's also other things, too. And I'm not going to go into the details, but maybe I think Donnie's writing a book about this stuff. And, you know, it's like, I don't want to name names. I'll let Donnie do it if he's going to do it.
Sure.
But I got Me Too'd big time. I like the I'll ruin your career kind of stuff with big people. I got hit in the worst way where the industry just was repulsed by how it worked. It was so disgusted at how the industry worked.
From a label and studio and management aspect, I mean, there's definitely a pretty nasty underside.
Oh, yeah. And especially the 90s was bad. I mean, I'm sure the 70s and 80s were terrible. Maybe it's better
even,
now.
Even in the 2000s, I know that there were some labels and execs that were offering a lot of stuff that is...
Yeah, would be considered not okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I can name people who were angels, because they were the people at London Records, 95% of them were fantastic people that I would work with again today. And then there were people that I wouldn't. But, you know, that was disheartened. And then I also had children.
Yeah.
And between the two of it, I was like, well, I can waste away. And I stopped writing music when I was on the road, because we toured, like I said, 270-something days a year. You just lose your soul. And I stopped writing music. And so, you know, we can't deliver another album if I'm not writing. I was like, I'm going home to my kids.
Yeah.
That's it, you know.
I get it. I get it. When you have kids, it's...
But it devastated the band. Yeah. The band was devastated. Because, I mean, I basically just left them in the cold. And I feel so guilty about it. They did well afterward. But, I mean, I just didn't do it right. I just completely bailed. But anyway, that's how that ended.
Yeah, well, I mean...
I don't want to hit. You know, I don't want to be... There was always, you know, because the Green Day thing, you know, we were touring at the same time as Green Day and building up, and they were like always doing the comparison. That's the major label just wants another Green Day, and we didn't want to be that. So it's like, no, I'm not going to do that. There was that one time they asked, hey, can your drummer play a ska beat? You know, because ska was coming out. And we're just like, no, it's just not having any conversations. We're just going to make our music and do our thing, and they just wouldn't have it.
I was thinking about that. Actually, on the drive over here, I was thinking, you know, I bet you they shared the stage with some big ska bands at the time, because that was huge.
Yeah, we toured with Safe Ferris. It was awesome. Boston's. The Boston's were one of our biggest supporters. They took us on. We played a show in Dallas with them. They took us on, and we toured with them for months and months and months. And that crowd, their audience hated us. But every night, Dickie would come up on stage, and he would defend me. He would yell at people that were throwing stuff at me. He would stand behind me or in front of me. He even bought me some steel tip shoes. And he told me, he was like, don't take it, man. I'll be right behind you, you know. And he was the most wonderful, supportive guy. And eventually we won the fans over, or some of them anyway. Yeah, so we played with a lot of ska bands. But, you know, that was the time.
That's got to be a tough thing. I remember seeing Jimmy World open for somebody, maybe it was Foo Fighters.
Oh, yeah.
And the crowd hated it. Yeah. And I loved it, because I mean, they're not Texas, so I'm not going to go into details about them, but they're a magical band.
Great band, yeah.
And
who got the shitty end of the stick.
To see an audience not appreciate the art is the hardest thing to see.
Well, and aggressively dislike them.
Yeah.
Like, because we got stuff thrown at us and, you know, did verbal abuse, and it was just...
I think the throwing thing, though, was a thing... I guess it still is at certain shows, but
yeah.
I mean, we were talking about Joe Butcher earlier, and I remember, I think the first time I saw UFOFU They were on a bill with a few other bands. Tripping Daisy was headlining, yeah. And people were throwing shoes and stuff.
Well, no, I understand.
Joe would throw them back. And,
yeah. Because, I mean, to me, that's a very compatible lineup. But, yeah. But you know, when you're playing with Deep Blue Something in your Hagfish, that's different. If you're at the Metro in Chicago and you're opening up for Deep Blue Something, that's going to get weird.
Yeah.
You know,
that's more weird. Like the Beastie Boys and Madonna type of mashup.
And that happened.
Yep. But, you know, I was reading about that. I think Ad Rock said that they were specifically chosen by Madonna because Madonna knew that by the time she took the stage, the fans would be so ready for her because they hated Beastie Boys.
But she also loved the Beastie Boys.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I think she was pulling one on everybody. She wanted to promote a band she liked, and she was, you know, it's kind of a middle finger too. Yeah.
I think there's a whole dynamic. There's probably a whole podcast that could be discussed about that aspect. But then I think about shows. I saw Toadies on a bill that opened for Tripping Daisy.
And it's weird.
Even though they're different, it worked. The crowd crowd loved both. Granted, you know, it was a Dallas show. So
then what I'm doing now, you know, you've heard the pop song.
Yeah.
Imagine that band opening for Toadies. It may actually happen, but what's going to happen? Because we have some very loud noise rock stuff, and then we've got some very poppy stuff, and the crowd may like it. We may get hit with shoes. Who knows? You know.
Okay.
Can't wait for that to happen.
let's discuss this. Do you want to start discussing some of the new stuff? Do you want to? So you said that you kind of had a quiet, secluded era.
Yeah.
And you're coming out of that.
Yeah.
Do you want to get into that now?
Sure. Yeah. I completely quit all music and thought to myself, you know, I got kids. I got to get my crap together, insurance, you know, this and that. And so I did. I went into that rabbit hole and I did it well because I wanted to do it. I loved my kids and was very, very happy. But as my kids grew up and they needed me less, you know, I realized I was still hearing music all the time. I just wasn't putting it on anything. And so over time it became very painful to hear music that I wasn't putting on anything. And then the last 4 or 5 years, most of my children are off in college or adults. I mean, my youngest girls are 21 years old. They're twins and they're about to graduate. And I'm like, oh crap. And empty nest syndrome. But at the same time, I really have got more music now than I've ever had in my life. And to me, some of it is the best music, most real music I've ever written. And it hurts to not put it out. I mean, I'm depressed about it. So I went through like the last 2 years of my life, I was very depressed. I mean, that's the whole reason I moved to Denton, was to do the music thing and then the COVID thing. So it's like, I got to go ahead for my family and they were like, yeah, you should do it because it's all you think about. And so I got my voice back. I learned how to play guitar really well, as good as I can. And then I've been writing like crazy. Which is a weird thing because I take a medication that keeps me from hearing music. And I don't know if this works for everybody. But you hear like Brian Wilson talking about the voices in his head and all that. So when I went to see a neurologist, they gave me a medication that allowed me to interact with the outside world more and be less just all internal. Because I mean, if you give me a task or let me hide, I will just go into the internal self and just be there and nothing on the outside matters, right? That also makes it hard to pay bills and take care of kids. So I had to find a solution. So those medications work really well. And I wouldn't say they're a fix for autism by any means. They treat some of the symptoms and they allow me to do things and think about things that I should be doing instead of my brain doing what it wants to do all the time. So I just kind of stopped taking some of that medication, like maybe half of it, or just not take it for 3 weeks. And it's like, boom, the music's incredibly overwhelming. And that's when I write. I just let it all come out. So I've been calling those music writing holidays. Take 3 weeks off of work. Don't take my medication. And it's as loud as it's ever been. I thought that went away. It didn't. So that's what you're getting.
It's an interesting way to look at it. Because a lot of the stuff that you describe is very familiar to me and my household.
Yeah.
When you use the word fixed. I know the way you
air quotes. Yeah, air quotes because
people,
I don't want
people couldn't see that because I know the way you mean it.
Don't mean fixed is not a thing.
Yeah, what you're referring to is the way that you can best help coordinate or complement the real outside world,
yeah,
with the way that you experience the world.
Social integration and what, yes, their expectations are. Yeah, their version of what fixed is. But that's, yeah, not really, it's, no, really a battle.
Because autism doesn't need fixing.
No.
It just needs to figure out how to coordinate with.
And that's the other thing too. Yeah. There's so much going on inside, especially, and music has always been the thing, right? So there's so much going inside. And like I said, as I get older, I start having thoughts about, well, like when COVID, my brother was in a coma, and I was like, oh my God, he's got like 3 albums of music and we're never going to release it. Oh shit, I've got even more than that. I'm never going to release it. We're going to die. I got to get it out. And that's when the pain started and the depression. And that's when I just kind of like stopped taking that medication. And I would just sit in the yard in the mornings, because that's when I used to write all the Hagfish stuff. I'd drink coffee in the mornings, have a cigarette. For 3 or 4 hours every day, that would be my thing. And then I would just play what I was hearing in my head until somebody said, I like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I've been doing. And it's so liberating.
I think too, and there's probably somebody who is a scientist or psychologist or whatever area this falls under, but I think you're also following a very regular human condition where as your kids become adults, mm, and you're reaching a new stage,
yeah,
that's a natural progression. Because I know my kids are all driving now,
but
and they've,
yeah,
all got jobs and they're graduating. And that's when I realized, hey, you know, I spent the last 10 years shying away from photographing so much music. And I've just been taking corporate clients, and then I still shot for like the Dallas Morning News and D Magazine. But you know, I pulled myself away from being in that scene. In the last, yeah, couple of years now, I've been like, you know what, I need to go back out and
we're doing the same
this.
Thing. Yeah. We're doing the same thing. Yep. Yeah. But there is that, and that's beautiful. The thing about it is like, yeah, there's the aspect of growing up and taking care of your family. But yeah, it hurts to not be creative. Especially when you start thinking about mortality.
Yeah.
And I think, well, how many years of music have I just, you know, let go? At least a decade and a half. I just didn't even try. So, I mean, and this is how John does it. I don't think John takes any medication. John just lets it come out all the time. Yeah. He's made that sacrifice. So he's 24/7. And I envy that and respect that so much, because it is a privilege to be able to just let the music come out that you hear.
It helps to know that you have the people around you to help make that happen.
Oh, absolutely. That's the, I wouldn't do it without all that support. I mean, the kids, I mean, I have 5 kids, right? And my wife, it's wonderful. And my brother, and they're like, yeah, you got to do it. And anybody else be like, you're crazy. You're crazy, you know, you got to retire and all this and that. And I'm like, well, yeah, I do, but I also got to be happy.
You know, speaking about kids, some of the demos you shared with me are stuff that your kids did. We talked talked about John, and he's sharing the stage with his daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what are your thoughts on this multi-generational artist thing going on?
Well, I mean, it's weirdly enough, I saw it like as soon as they were able to talk. It was like living in a musical, ad-libbed the whole time. And in harmony, my kids, they were like a pair of me, but like way better at like verbalizing the music. I mean, they just came straight out of their mouths. They didn't have to like, because I hear it all inside and I have to try to fight to get it out. But it's like immediate, kind of like, one of my sons was diagnosed with Tourette's, and that makes sense because he can't stop it.
Mm-hmm.
With 24/7 musical. Now he works a job and he's doing good and all that, but I realized that my kids have what I have, but they're accelerated, and you know, like one of my sons is a music teacher at a school. I mean, so they love music and they've got more music than me, but they're also don't want to be famous. But I did this little experiment with my kids, and I was like, well, you're all adults now, we can go, let's go rehearse and let's work on some songs. We all have lots of songs, and let's play some shows. And a friend of mine, John Snodgrass, tricked me into playing 3 shows with him, because he pulled me out of obscurity. Because every year he would say, you're gonna come play some shows with me? I'm like, no, I don't do that anymore. And so finally he got me at a party in Dallas. They suckered me into going to the party. It was him and Stefan Egerton, Dissonance, playing and singing, and then they played a couple of Hagfish songs and everybody sang, and then they made me sing, and I was like, oh shit, they got me. And John's like, yeah, you've got three shows. And this was like in December. He says, three shows in May. You get that long to get your shit together. So I got my kids and we rehearsed and we played three shows with them. And my middle son was like, this is all I ever want to do for the rest of my life. I said, okay, but you got a full-time job teaching kids music. He's like, yeah, I want to do this though. We'll make it happen. So it's going to happen. And they got more music than me. They actually have more talent than me. And they have more, I don't even know how to say it. They're more like John. And so how do you introduce that? I mean, my brother is more musical than me. But he's hiding right. He's sleeping right now. He works a night shift. He could never put his music out, and it would be a shame. I mean, you heard it.
Yeah, that stuff.
Tons of it.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Yeah, I mean, so this is what we have. We've got four people who consistently and constantly write and are very musical, and we don't know what to do with ourselves. So maybe we'll put it out. I don't know. I got to start somewhere. Starting somewhere is with getting my shit together and getting good again at what I do, and then being able to express myself on stage, and then I have a band, just like I found the guys in Hagfish. I found the guys in La Glacier, when I met the band and met Chris, I was instant friends, best friends. He's got a studio here in town. He just needed the same, what equipment he doesn't have, I have, and we combined it all, and it's like we have everything we need. It feels just like that moment when I met Hagfish. I just found my band, and so it's going to take a while. But
yeah, no, that makes sense. I'm going to guess, just looking at the numbers that I've got on the recorder, this is probably going to be the longest episode that I've done to date. This is episode number 17. I'm totally fine with it because, I mean, literally, I could sit here and probably talk for another hour or two.
We probably could.
But I think what we need to do for the sanity of our listeners is let's wrap this up and maybe one day we'll do just a second episode.
Absolutely.
I feel like we barely touched on anything.
Yeah.
But this was absolutely enjoyable.
I really like talking to you about this stuff, yeah. Because, you know, I don't talk to too many people about things.
I think we have enough similarities that we understand kind of each other.
Yeah, we chat online, and I'm like, I really like, I tell them, I really like, just like John.
Yeah.
And a few other people, for some reason, chatting with you is different than chatting with everybody else. You know, I got like five people now that I didn't have before who I can connect with and have a weird bond with. And it's awesome. It's like, okay, is that five friends? Maybe. Potential friends. If I can be a friend, it's hard for me to be a friend because I'm always a recluse. But
yeah,
I need to stop being a recluse.
but at the same time, it helps that you don't necessarily have to see somebody face to face to still have interaction.
Oh, I mean,
but between all our texting and stuff, I mean, we've discussed quite a bit of music lately. That's for sure. Your demos are just blowing me away.
Oh man, thank you so
much.
They're
nuts.
They're interesting. They're just demos. It's the rough first thought.
Our listeners haven't heard it. I should probably say it's not Hagfish.
Oh no, not at all.
I know you and I discussed the influences that some of this stuff was coming from.
Yeah.
There's a little Kraftwerk.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You picked all of them. You actually nailed all of them. Yeah.
I love that kind of stuff. So I can't wait for everyone who has not heard it yet to hear it.
Well, the funny thing is a lot of that stuff is stuff that we would argue in Hagfish about. Because we all had stuff that we agreed on that we liked.
Yeah.
But then the weird Georges come out and they would call me, what did they call Jim Morrison in that movie? The something Snake King or what, Lizard King?
Yeah.
Yeah, they'd say, oh, Lizard King's back because he's listening to whatever, you know. And but then I always had all these influences and loves of music. Hagfish was just a small faction of that. So this is what you're going to get. You're going to get kind of like a, and it may be awful, who knows. It's going to be an outpouring of all of my actual influences, not just Bill Stevenson and Milo, the people who like propelled my teens and my 20s.
Yeah.
And them who I owe everything to, but you're going to hear all the other stuff.
Well, what if we close out the show? Is there a demo that is good enough? I shouldn't say good enough.
What I mean
is complete
presentable?
Enough.
Presentable?
Yes.
Complete enough?
You and I understand the process of music, so yeah. When I hear a demo, I can picture the finished product. Do you have one that is complete enough that the average listener is ready to hear?
I have one that John said he wants to mix ASAP. Oh,
perfect.
You've heard it. Is it done? The band is doing like wild stuff to it right now, but there's no reason why you can't have a single and an alternate single.
Sure. I hate saying this. Mm. I'm not a huge Weezer fan anymore, but up until Maladroit, mm-hmm. And then he, right after that, he released several kind of demo albums. It was all this stuff. I forget what he labeled it in my. I can't even remember the title.
I know what you're talking about, though, because I went through it too, and I was like, "Well, there's some hope."
Yeah. So in any case, I love when bands release a rough demo. Just, you know.
Yeah.
I'll give you a perfect example. So Ben Queller.
Oh, Ben Queller. Yeah.
He had a song that was released on a promo only CD as. I think it was only two tracks. It was the track that the label was pushing, and they had a demo on there.
Yeah.
And it was rough. Sounded like it was recorded maybe on like a Tascam cassette deck. And
I love those.
Yeah, they're neat.
And it's different listening to my own demos than thinking, oh, because I don't hear that because I'm too attached to it. But other people can go, oh yeah, I would play that. And that's what I got from John and a couple other people is, oh, you should. This is so close. Let me just take it and fix it. And then
I love demos. And especially with like the Ben Queller one, hearing that demo version. And then he later used the song on one of his solo albums, all polished, and getting to compare the two and weigh them and see how the song progressed. Yeah. I love that. So if you're okay with us playing a demo right now.
Yeah, I am.
And then later down the road, the listeners hear when the thing is all polished and finished. Hopefully that gives them more of a connection.
And the thing is you're going to hear some dramatic changes.
Yeah.
I mean, the hope is that we're doing South by Southwest by 2025. And the hope is that we will get an awesome label that I want to be on. I'm hoping, in a 4AD, I'm not going to say that to jinx myself, but that's the type of label where it's the integrity of the art that means the most to them. And hopefully that's still true. And then there's producers who I feel the same way about. They're there for the art of the music, not necessarily for record sales. And those are the people that I'm looking for. And so when you hear these demos, when you hear the record version, it's probably going to be something completely different because there's not really a limit.
You know, even if you just wind up on a local label, I mean, think about the stuff that's
either
still
way.
Around. Think about the fact that you could still be on Idol.
Oh, I would. I love Idol.
You could be on, I know they're only releasing retro stuff right now, but G.I. Sanders.
It's awesome.
And his, what is it, DFW Legacy Series label.
It's awesome. I'm going to give you one of those, by the way, before you leave.
Yeah, cool.
But yeah, he's awesome. Irv. Mm-hmm. Idol is incredible. I've had a relationship with him since the beginning of Hagfish. He's always been... We stayed at his house in Chicago. That's another story for another time. But yeah, I would always work with him. I mean, there's plenty of labels here I would work with. I just...
No, you got your set site.
Well, my set site is artistic freedom.
Your site
freedom.
Set. I said that backwards.
Yeah, site
set. You got set. Your site set.
Artistic freedom, which could happen with a local label. Like, it could happen with any label. I'm not going to do what I don't want to do.
No, that makes sense. That makes perfect
I don't care
sense.
About the money
sure.
at this point in life. I just care about getting it out the way I want it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect. All right. So we got permission to play a wonderful demo. And
to be named. We don't know which song yet.
Well, let's commit right this second. Which one do you want me to play?
Okay. Oh. We can commit to One of Us Will Die Before the Other.
Oh, yeah, that's gorgeous. That's a great one. Let's play this brand new music, and we're going to say goodbye to our listeners. We're going to thank George, and I'm going to obviously say Patreon again, because I don't make money on this show. I need your help. Come back next week. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Too late.